From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Like many victims of crime, Gary Geiger was haunted by questions. Why did the robbery turn violent? Why did one of the robbers shoot him? But Geiger got to do something that few crime victims have the chance to do. He asked the man who shot him. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with Gary Geiger and with Tom Christian, director of the mediation program that put Geiger face-to-face with his attacker. Also today, the civil rights movement, as seen through the eyes of a 12-year-old girl. We talk with Tulani Davis about her semi-autobiographical novel, 1959. TV critic David Bianculli reviews two new shows on Fox, and classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews a new reissue by the Budapest String Quartet. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The head of the United Nations Weapons Inspection Program said today that the UN will accept Iraq's offer to allow inspection flights to resume without conditions. Rolf Ikea said the Iraqi offer to allow inspectors to fly their own planes into Iraq should be taken seriously. Ikea said that he'd received a communique explaining Iraq's initiatives, including an offer to observe a ceasefire in the northern and southern no-fly zones. Ikea said that weapons inspectors will resume their flights as soon as it's feasible. Whatever the motive behind Iraq's conciliatory gestures, they appear likely to reduce the current level of tension. Reporter Michael McMillan describes the situation in Baghdad.
The feeling here is that this is going to take a lot of the tension that we've seen over the past few days out of the situation. And if you're not going to have Iraqi radars and Iraqi anti-aircraft batteries firing and locking on to Allied aircraft, well, then you're going to remove a lot of the reason for this conflict. Now, if you add to that that the Iraqis have also said tonight that the UN inspection team, which is stranded in Bahrain and has been stranded in Bahrain for the past week or more, that they can enter Iraq unconditionally, provided this ceasefire works, well, then you've got a recipe for the first real compliance with UN resolutions. And that has to be good news.
Michael McMillan in Baghdad. President Bush is spending his last full day at the White House shaking hands and saying goodbye. The president had no public appearances on his schedule, but is said to be sharing his thoughts privately with friends and advisors. NPR's Brian Naylor reports.
Among those Mr. Bush bid farewell to were the White House groundskeepers, who will stay on to groom the lawns and gardens for the next occupants, the Clintons. Mr. Bush signed a bill extending Secret Service protection to Dan Quayle for another 6 months, and then had lunch with the vice president. According to White House spokesman Marlon Fitzwater, the president was in a very good mood. He said U.S.-led attacks on Iraq kept the president from finding the time to give a farewell address to the nation or his own staff. The president has invited the Reverend Billy Graham to spend the night, the Bushes last at the White House. Tomorrow, the Clintons come by in the morning for coffee, and then they'll leave together for the Capitol and the inauguration. Mr. Bush then flies off to Houston, and Mr. Clinton moves into the White House. This is Brian Naylor in Washington.
Stock prices came to a mixed close today, with the blue chip issues pulled down by a report of record year-end losses for the world's biggest computer maker, IBM. The Dow Jones Industrial Average lost nearly 19 points to close at 3,256. Advances edged declines in heavy trading. Volume on the New York Stock Exchange was 283 million shares. This is NPR News. President-elect Clinton's choice for attorney general said today that she knew she was breaking federal law when she hired illegal immigrants as servants. Zoe Baird told the Senate Judiciary Committee that she was acting as a mother instead of a lawyer when she hired an undocumented Peruvian woman to care for her young son. Baird said that she and her husband paid the woman and her husband, who acted as their chauffeur, $2,000 a month plus room and board. They did not pay Social Security taxes for the couple. Baird comes to the Attorney General nomination from a $500,000-a-year job as general counsel for the Aetna Life and Casualty Company. The first space shuttle mission of the year is over. The shuttle Endeavour glided back to Earth this morning. Dave Pignanelli of member station WMFE reports.
By all of NASA's accounts, this first mission of the year appears to be a success. The crew completed its primary goal during its first day in orbit, the release of a $200 million communications satellite. Other work included a two-man spacewalk and a physics lesson for elementary school students in several states. The crew even turned off one of its power-producing fuel cells during the last day of the mission. The cells provide electricity for the orbiter, and NASA wanted to see if they would switch back on again while in space. It's a conservation issue that will be helpful in the building of a space station. The only black mark on this mission was the weather during today's landing. Ground fog prevented the shuttle from returning as scheduled and sent the crew on one more Earth orbit. By the time the sun rose above the Florida horizon, the fog had cleared, and the shuttle returned safely to Kennedy's concrete runway. For National Public Radio, I'm Dave Pignanelli reporting.
The nation's biggest banking company surprised many analysts today by reporting better earnings for 1992 than most had predicted. Citicorp, the parent company of Citibank, said that it made a profit for the fourth quarter and for the year as a whole. I'm Corey Flintoff. This is NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Many victims of violent crime would like to ask their assailants, why did you hurt me? My guest Gary Geiger recently got to ask this question of the man who shot him in 1981. The meeting between Geiger and his assailant, Wayne Blanchard, was held under the auspices of the Victim Offender Mediation Program, which is part of the New York court system. The director of the program, Tom Christian, is also with us. The meeting was held in the Ellensville prison, where Blanchard is serving time for shooting Geiger. Their meeting was videotaped for the HBO documentary Confronting Evil, which debuts tonight. Back in 1981, Geiger was a nationally ranked weightlifter and championship sprinter. He earned his living as the night auditor of a small hotel outside Albany, New York. That's where he was robbed and shot.
It was a tough area, the motel where I worked at. And it was one of the slowest nights that I ever had. And I thought, like most people, that I was immune to violent crime. I was strong, I was fast, and I thought that I could handle anything that came my way. But on the morning of August 13th, around 3 a.m., I never expected what I encountered.
What happened?
We had four young men enter the motel, two of which approached me at the desk. One fanned out to my left, which was our bar area. One fanned out to my right, which is our restaurant area. I was fairly streetwise, and I was a banker 10 years previous to this, so I went through training for robbery. So I knew how to handle one, and I knew that this was going to be a robbery right away. So I knew only to speak when spoken to and just be polite, and that's exactly what I was.
And yet you were shot.
Yes.
How did they shoot you?
Well, after being beaten about the head, with gun butts and fists, told to get on the ground. My glasses were ripped off my face, causing a cut in the inside of my eye. What happened was I was brought into a back room and put on the carpet, thick carpeting. They saw a locked safe, which they thought I could open. The gun was placed to my temple twice and cocked. I tried to tell them in a sincere voice that I didn't have the combination. They hit me in the back of the head, and to knock me out, I pretended I was knocked out. I heard them running away, and I thought that, my God, I'm alive. I made it through. They're gone. I jumped up, and I heard a cannon-like sound coming from my rear.
And that was the shot?
It was the shot,
And
yes.
Where did it get you?
It hit me in the lower back. It penetrated my lung. It broke two ribs and hit my stomach muscle and stopped. And the bullet is still embedded in my stomach muscle to this day.
Why couldn't they get it out?
It's too deep. They figured they would be in there probably 5 hours or more. They would have cut much of the built-up muscle that I had trained for all those years, and they decided to leave it alone.
So what was the psychological after effect of being shot?
Well, initially, victims of violent crime go through various stages: anger, depression, guilt, denial, and I went through all of them. I was initially very angry, out for vengeance. And at the trials, victims of violent crime have never been a part of our criminal justice system. And I was traumatized and victimized again by going on the stand for 2.5 hours for my offender's trial, and during which I was called names, I was ridiculed. And the incident gained so much publicity that the defendant's attorney actually asked me if I was trying to further my athletic career with the publicity. And the questions that I had for my defendant started formulating at the trial. I even asked the DA if I could sit in a room with him and his attorney and ask him some questions, but of course it was denied because victims have never been part of the criminal process.
Who ridiculed you?
His attorney, the defendant's attorney.
For what?
Well, I think she was trying to grasp at straws, actually. She was trying to break down my testimony that I couldn't identify him, which in the beginning I could not. But because of the traumatic nightmares I was having every night, I started to, after a period of time, seeing my defendant's faces in my nightmares. And actually, we may have set a precedent in this case. We convicted them on my nightmares, ironically, believe it or not.
Has he's admitted to the crime?
Oh, yes. Yes, yeah. He wanted to admit to the crime right there and then, but the district attorney rejected his plea bargain and had me go on the stand for a grueling 2.5 hours and be victimized again, rather than having the victim part of the system and saying, look, he wants to plead guilty. What do you think? If you go on the stand, you're going to be put through extensive cross-examination. If he pleads guilty, he's probably going to get 5 to 7 years. I didn't know that until the mediation last July.
Now, why did you want to participate in this kind of mediation process? Why did you want to meet him 11 years after the crime?
Well, I had questions initially right from the start that I wanted to ask, and over the years, they became haunting questions. Why did you shoot me? Did you indeed try to kill me? Did you think about firing a second shot? And why did the incident get so violent when I was so polite and cooperative? And these questions, these years, burned inside me. It was affecting my life. I was suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder, which I didn't know about then. I was treating my family, my friends and coworkers, sometimes with disdain, and sometimes if someone would approach me in what I thought was a violent manner, I would react. And it was a defense mechanism because I vowed never to put myself in that position that I was in 11 years ago, being trapped and being defenseless.
In the TV show, which has the documentary segment of your encounter with the person who shot you, Wayne Blanchard, you ask him, why did you do it when I complied? I did everything that you said. And Blanchard said that when he walked back into the room, you had gotten up and he thought that you were going to set off an alarm.
Yes.
And you said to him, but there was no alarm. I couldn't have set off an alarm. Did you believe him when he said that?
I did. He was the lookout. All these years, again, I thought he was the one that had put the gun to my temple, cocked it, and asked for the combination to the safe. And one of the things that we found out, and there was a few surprises in the mediation, I found out that he wasn't the person that put the gun to my temple. He was the lookout. And what he did was something told him to come back into the room after his cohorts had left to see if I was still knocked out. Well, the exact moment that he walked in, I had jumped up. And no, there was no alarm there. It was an old-style motel, and there was indeed no alarm. I would have hit an alarm right away because I knew what was happening. I knew it was a robbery. So there was no way I was going for an alarm.
So this was a big question for you. Why did you do it when I complied? He gave you an answer. The answer was he thought you were going for an alarm. What did that answer do for you? What did it give you?
Well, it started to release a lot of the anger and the bitterness that I had. Some of my anger was directed at Wayne Blanchard. Some of my anger was directed at the criminal justice system. But it started to create a curative effect in me because he was opening up to me. He wasn't just sitting there with a prison face on. He was starting to converse with me, and the look in his eye, the profuse sweating, told me that this guy is going to tell me everything that I want to know, that I've been waiting to know.
Now, the fact that he told you that he thought you were reaching for an alarm, did that make you think, well, at least there was some logic behind the shooting?
Yes, I think it was an instinctive reaction that he tried to keep me from reaching for an alarm because he thought that they were going to get caught. See, he was out on parole, and he certainly didn't want any trouble because he would have been back in again. He was out on parole for another felony violation.
I have an excerpt of the tape with me that I want to play, the tape of your encounter with the person who shot you. And this is like the real big question, so let me play this excerpt.
Mm-hmm. Can you tell me, please, why you shot me?
Okay, like I say, somebody has said, okay, let's get out of here, right? So the running noise you heard must have been us leaving. right? So something told me in my head to go back and check you, right? So when I come back in the room, I found that you were getting up and sort of going to a box on the wall. And I thought that that was an alarm that you was running to, all right? And I know that had you had pulled the alarm, it would have hindered our escape. So I called you and I said, hey. And when you turned around, that's when I fired the shot and ran.
Did you try to kill me?
Oh, no. I believe if I had any intentions on actually killing you, that I would have fired more than one shot.
Did you think about firing the second time when I ran toward the door?
I can't remember that part of it because I fired one shot and I turned and I ran.
The motel was old. There was no alarm system. When I jumped up, I was just scared, that's all. I suppose it was just, all I kept saying in my mind was just take what you want and leave. I didn't care. It wasn't my money. I would have helped you out to the car with it. It wasn't mine. They're insured. I was just worried about myself. I just said, just take what you want and go. I had nothing against you.
Gary, what was going through your mind during that part of the conversation?
Well, I was listening to his explanation very carefully, and I think it coincided with what I remember from that night. I don't remember him yelling, hey, but he could have. I was cut. I was dazed. I jumped up and because I thought they had left, and I accepted his explanation. I think everything he said was correct.
Now, Blanchard told you that he was truly sorry for what happened in the motel that night. What did that apology mean to you? What's an apology worth?
Well, I think to the layman that someone might say an apology is kind of trivial, isn't it, after 11 years? But to a victim of a violent crime, an apology can be very, very profound. I went in there. My big goal in that mediation was to get an apology for my family and me. I wasn't going to ask for it. I wasn't going to beg for it. If it came, I wanted it to come from him. And at the most opportune time, there were no props in there. There was no script. He started to apologize sincerely to me and my family. And I started to choke up, and I had to compose myself. It was very, very powerful, the way he said it.
And you never doubted
No.
the honesty of the apology?
No, because I looked him. See, in the courtroom, when I identified him, I went right up to him. He looked every which way but at me. So eye contact is very, very important. In the mediation, he looked me dead in the eye for 50 minutes. Right in the eye, one-on-one, no cameras, just him and I. And he never took his eyes off me, and that said a lot.
My guest is Gary Geiger. He was shot in 1981, and he recently met his attacker under the auspices of the Victim Offender Mediation Program of the State of New York. Gary, I'm going to bring in Tom Christian, and he's the director of the Community Dispute Resolution Centers program for the New York court system. He was your mediator at the mediation. He worked with you at the mediation. Tom, are you with us?
Yes, I am.
When Gary came to you and asked to meet Wayne Blanchard, is that how it worked? Did he come to you?
Yes. Yes, he did.
Uh-huh. Did he seem like a good candidate for this kind of mediation program?
Well, that's the first thing that we look for, is why does someone want to sit down with someone who almost killed him? And if it's just for revenge, then what we do is we talk with them and try to help them, but we're not going to take it any further. If it's someone who needs to let go, needs to get information, needs to get answers to their questions, someone who has gone through the bitterness and the anger and the hostility and is at a point where they want to accept the situation, they want to deal with the individual as a human being, then we say this is a candidate for victim offender mediation. And Gary Geiger was that candidate.
Now, what about Wayne Blanchard, who's in prison? Did you have to figure out if he was a good candidate for mediation?
Exactly. We go down to the prison. We sit down with Wayne Blanchard. We sit down with his counselor. We talk to him and try to find some answers. The first thing that Wayne Blanchard said to me is, if this will help Gary Geiger, I will do it. So we knew then that he was a good candidate. We talked with his counselor, talked with him in depth, prepared him for some of the possibilities. And when I came back from the prison, I had Gary sit down again and went over it with him. And we said, we have a go.
What kind of prisoner would you have decided was inappropriate to mediation?
If the person had no remorse, if they took no responsibility, if he would have said, yeah, I was there, but it wasn't me, it was my partner, no, I didn't want to shoot him, no, I didn't shoot him. If he would have said, well, I can't understand why this guy wants to meet with me, but I'll meet with him if he wants to. I don't know what it's going to do, if it's not going to do any good. If there's no sign of remorse, you know, then it's a waste of everybody's time. There was that sign of remorse there. I mean, he admitted to it. He said, I shot him. I'm really sorry. You know, I was young. I was dropped out of school. I was smoking dope. I was drinking beer. I was standing on the corner. They said, let's go make some money. He said, I was stupid. He had buried this within himself, too, the guilt. And he did have Gary Geiger as a faceless person, someone behind a counter who might have turned an alarm in on them. So this was almost like opening up to him that this was a human being that is hurt. This is a human being that you've dealt with. And you have to sit down as one man to another in this particular case and deal with it.
I know I'm probably more cynical than the average person, but do you ever... Do you ever think when you're talking to someone in prison who you're approaching for a possible mediation, that when they show their remorse, that maybe they're just faking it to for a better outcome at their parole hearing or whatever?
Mm-hmm. Well, one of the things we tell them is that that's not part of the bargain. We're not going to say to your parole hearing people that you've done a good job here and lighten up on him. We will say that he did go through the victim offender mediation, that we felt that he was sincere. So again, you know, as I say, I've dealt with people in trouble with the law for 30 years. They say you can't con a con. You know, if they try to con me, I usually tell them, look, if that's what you believe, if that's what you think, that's fine. That's your life. I don't believe you. So therefore, I'm not going to pretend. I have trouble with what you're saying. And we confront them directly.
Gary, I have another question for you.
Mm-hmm.
Most people, if they are victimized, afterwards, I mean, you get scared. You wonder, will it happen again? Will it be tonight? Am I safe today? I'm sure you went through a period of being afraid
mm-hmm.
after you were shot. Has that ended? And if so, when did it end?
Oh, I think it's ended. It could happen again. I don't know. I hope it doesn't. For a while, I was looking in my rearview mirror 5 times more than the average person. If I went into a restaurant, I checked the exits. And looking over my shoulder, being jittery. See, most victims of violent crime are like that. And many victims of violent crime feel ashamed, they feel guilty. 2 reasons, the trauma that they went through and the trauma that they went through with the criminal justice system makes them feel guilty, and I felt all of that. But I think this is going to be one of the first times on national TV you're going to see a victim of a violent crime tell it like it is.
Gary Geiger's encounter with his assailant, Wayne Blanchard, mediated by Tom Christian, was filmed for the HBO documentary Confronting Evil, which premieres tonight. Gary Geiger has decided to testify on Wayne Blanchard's behalf at his parole hearing next year. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Last fall, the Fox Television Network pulled two new series from its announced fall schedule, a youth drama called Class of 96 and a comedy drama called Key West. And it held them for mid-season. Mid-season is upon us, and tonight, so are those two series. TV critic David Bianculli has a review.
I can understand why Fox put off the premieres of these programs. The fall was full of youth appeal shows, and Class of 96 would have been lumped in with all the mindless clones of Beverly Hills 90210. And Key West also risked getting lost in the clutter because its tropical setting and quirky characters made it very similar to a new ABC series, Going to Extremes. But now that Class of 96 and Key West have finally shown up, both of them defy expectations. Class of 96, which looks at college life from the point of view of first-year students, is a lot better than expected. And Key West, which stars Fisher Stevens as a lottery winner who heads to South Florida to emulate Ernest Hemingway, is a lot worse. I really wanted and expected Key West to be good. It's got a talented cast and a few scenes that make strong use of the Key West locale. But the two episodes I've seen are disappointing. They try too hard, succeed too rarely, and basically show why Northern exposure is such a hard act to follow. However, there is one very persuasive reason to tune in. Jennifer Tilly. She played Henry Goldblum's wife on Hill Street Blues and a feisty lesbian on Dream On. And here she co-stars as a soft-hearted prostitute named Savannah. And even though the character is a cliché, Tilly's portrayal isn't. The only other actress on primetime TV to exude such playful sex appeal is Tia Leone, who plays Alicia on another Fox series, Flying Blind. You can't see what Tilly is doing or wearing in this scene, where she's hired as a birthday present for an 18-year-old young man, but you can hear her voice, and that's enough.
Today, you're gonna learn everything you're ever gonna need to know about women. I'm gonna teach you. And when you walk out of here tonight, you're gonna have a PhD in me. And your stock is gonna soar. And your self-confidence is gonna go through the roof. You hear what I'm telling you?
Yes, ma'am, I do.
Class of 96, on the other hand, is a lot more subtle. The characters start off just as pat as the ones in Key West. There's a sorority girl, a hardworking boy, an egotistical drama student, and so on. But they deepen quickly, and the details of student life make this the best TV series set in a school since The Paper Chase, though not, at least not yet, in the same class. Sometimes it's far-fetched. In what other youth-oriented drama series could you find a beautiful girl attracted to a classmate because he knows more than she does about Moby Dick? Here's part of that classroom scene. The English teacher is played by Peter Horton, who was Gary on 30-something. Horton directed the pilot, and his guest appearance is a little in-joke for 30-something fans. The students are played by Jason Gedrick and Lisa Dean Ryan.
I believe it's when Ahab nails the doubloon into the mast.
Very good. Very good. Isn't that also the scene where he gives his reason for hunting the whale?
Yes, though, I remember.
I'd strike the sun if it insulted me.
Excuse me?
I'd strike the sun if it insulted me. That's what Ahab says, but I don't mean to interrupt.
No, that's quite all right. I'd like to hear what Mr. Morrissey has to say, if that's okay.
Absolutely.
Well, Ahab, he wants revenge because the whale took his leg. And so when he first set out...
No, I disagree.
What, that's not a good enough reason?
Ahab says the whale is evil.
The guy
that's
lost
what he stands
his leg.
For. So Ahab's attacking the evil in the world.
No, it's not Ahab that says that. It's Melvin. And
it
it's not
matter.
Ahab. It does
it's
matter.
It's still Ahab.
And the chapter about the whiteness
of
the whale.
Good.
The whole
good.
Chapter.
Very good. Don't forget about your assignments tomorrow. And Miss Cullen, Mr. Morrissey, bring your harpoons.
Now, can you imagine Brenda and Dylan having the same sort of argument on 90210? Neither can I, which is why I like the Class of 96. The most significant thing about these new shows, though, is that they both look a lot like other TV series. Fox used to be known for innovation. This is just imitation.
David Bianculli is TV critic for the New York Post and author of Teleliteracy, Taking Television Seriously. This is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. At the age of 12, Tulani Davis was chosen to be one of the first black students to integrate an all-white school. It's the inspiration behind her novel 1959. Coming up, we talk about growing up during the civil rights movement. And classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews a new reissue of the Budapest String Quartet, playing Mozart quartets and quintets. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. President-elect Bill Clinton is spending his last day as a private citizen, and tomorrow he becomes the nation's 42nd president. NPR's Mara Liasson reports.
Clinton began his day with a 2.9-mile jog around the mall, accompanied by a group of classmates from Georgetown and a complete Secret Service and press entourage. And he made a visit to the gravesites of two of his political idols, John and Robert F. Kennedy. In a ceremony carefully arranged to produce the picture of the day, Clinton knelt before the grave, head bowed, and placed a white rose on the burial site. Later, he spoke to a group of present and former governors, telling them that he desperately wanted to make a difference as president. "I did not run for this job just to warm the seat," Clinton said. Clinton's transition operation moved forward today to fill more sub-cabinet jobs. 13 top State Department officials were named, and Clinton announced that former Vermont Governor Madeleine Cunin would be the number two at the Education Department. In Washington, I'm Mara Liasson.
New doubt has been thrown on meeting a U.S. deadline on the first of next month for turning over operations in Somalia to peacekeeping forces. A U.N. spokesman says that the U.N. will be able to take control of peacekeeping forces only gradually. Yesterday, another top U.N. official said the decision on handing over control is up to the U.N. Security Council and not to Washington. While more than 500 U.S. troops are heading home this week, there are some 25,000 American troops still in Somalia. A military spokesman had said that Washington was getting ready to transfer military control of Somalia to a U.N. command as early as next month. FBI Director William Sessions has been reprimanded by the U.S. Attorney General. In documents from the U.S. Justice Department released today, Sessions is accused of taking advantage of his government position. NPR's John Greenberg has more on the story.
Reports that Sessions was under investigation surfaced last October. The Justice Department made the official report public today, along with a memo from former Attorney General William Barr. In the documents, Sessions is accused of trying to evade income taxes by calling his limousine a tactical police vehicle. The designation allowed Sessions to avoid paying income tax on the value of the government limousine service that took him to and from work. Sessions is also faulted for using $10,000 of government money to build a security fence around his home and billing the government for trips to San Francisco to visit his daughter. Sessions has denied any wrongdoing. He has said he plans to serve the remaining 5 years left in his term. This is John Greenberg in Washington.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved down nearly 19 points to close at 3,255.99 on volume of more than 283 million shares. Advancing issues led declines by only a slight margin. This is NPR News. For the first time in 2 weeks, residents of Southern California are getting a chance to enjoy clear skies. On both sides of the border between the United States and Mexico, there has been widespread damage from bad weather, and deaths of more than 40 people have been died to the storms. Officials in San Diego County have reported some $36 million in damage from the heavy rainfall, with $5 million in the city of San Diego alone. Since the heavy rainfall began earlier this month, more than 17 inches of rain have fallen. The first study to look at the cost savings from computerizing medical records in hospitals was published this week in the Journal of the American Medical Association. As NPR's Patricia Naiman reports, the system saves hospitals millions of dollars.
The new computer network for medical records saved an Indianapolis hospital $900 on every patient hospitalized. It did that, says researcher Dr. William Tierney, by simply shaving the time from what doctors were spending writing and updating patient charts.
Medicine is the second largest industry in this country, second only to the automobile industry. And yet we're dealing with a pen and paper the same way that it was done 100 years ago.
The new electronic system allows doctors to print orders, request tests, and send drug orders via computer terminals stationed throughout the hospital. If used by hospitals nationwide, Tierney says the system could save billions of dollars a year. Quality of care didn't drop, he says. In fact, there was evidence the new system ensured quality. The number of calls from the pharmacy to clarify doctors' orders went down. I'm Patricia Naiman reporting.
Officials of Eastman Kodak have announced plans to cut some 2,000 jobs. Officials say that most of the job cuts will take place at company headquarters in Rochester, New York. Kodak has already eliminated 15,000 jobs. This is NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. At the age of 12, Tilani Davis was chosen to be one of the black students to integrate a white school in Virginia. She was prepared for the experience by her father and her teacher, in vain as it turned out, because the integration plan never went through. But it was still the beginning of the end for segregation in Hampton, Virginia. That same year, several young black men sat down at a local Woolworth's lunch counter, and soon the blacks of the town were boycotting white businesses. These experiences are the inspiration for Davis's novel, 1959. This is Tilani Davis's first novel. She used to write about African-American issues for the Village Voice. She also wrote the libretto for the opera X, The Life and Times of Malcolm X, which was recently released on CD. The novel 1959 will be published in paperback next month. I spoke to Davis when her novel was first published in 92 and asked how she felt about being chosen to integrate the school.
Really ambivalent. I think it was mostly frightening to me. I am actually glad I did not have that experience in the end. I think in black communities in that era, children grew up with a tremendous sense of responsibility drilled into them that, you know, you're a representative of the race and you must go forward and do well. We all had that, but the pressure that I think kids had on them who went to those schools, I think could barely be shared with anyone else. I think it was a pretty isolating experience.
In your novel, the father at first really is opposed to sending his daughter to this white school to integrate, but then he realizes that it's for the benefit of the civil rights struggle, and he feels that the family has a responsibility to participate. What was the process that your father went through in thinking it out? Do you remember?
Well, my father was very unusual, and he did a lot of his thinking aloud in my presence. So I knew he had a lot of misgivings about it. He told me he was very frightened for me personally. That was his main misgiving about it. And at the same time, I think he was proud that they thought his kid could make it through something like that. He had had many experiences like that himself in his own life, so he had a good idea, I think, what it would be like and what it would take. And I think, like most parents, he wasn't sure that his children were as tough as he had had to be in his life, because most of us have had harder lives than our children or people younger than us. So I think, in a sense, it gave him another sense of who I was, in a sense, by my being objectified by the other people who knew and dealt with me.
I think for a lot of people of your generation, they started participating in protests and pickets and boycotts and so on when they were teenagers, older teenagers, 17, 18, 19, 16 maybe. But you started participating in demonstrations and boycotts when you were 12, which is pretty young. Mm-hmm. Were you ever really frightened, especially considering you were in the South, there might have been police dogs mm-hmm. at the demonstrations as there are in scenes in your novel?
No, I wasn't. I'll tell you, when I came to Barnard, most of the girls who came, black girls who came in that year, there were 19 of us, were from the South, and most of us had experienced that. I don't think in the South that my experience was unusual, because the primary organizational tool in the South was the church, and they brought children, and that was a practice fairly early in the movement. And I think most people probably experienced marches mm-hmm. and that sort of thing. I also didn't find it frightening because, one, there wasn't a lot of violence in my town, but there's a sense of sheltering in a crowd of people consisting of everyone you know, that you have a sense that whatever happens, it's okay, because this is everyone you've ever known your whole life, or almost, and it doesn't feel as out of control as it felt for me in 1968 in New York City at a march against the war in Vietnam, where horses just charged us. I felt like I was going to get trampled and my father would never hear of me again. That was much more just anonymous and frightening, and the scope of it was quite large. Whereas in a southern town, you sort of know the faces you're looking at.
In the town that you write about, and I suspect in the town you grew up in as well, there are a lot of boycotts once the civil rights movement got underway, boycotts of white businesses that banned blacks from coming in or from sitting, at the counter. What effects did that have on the black community? Did it bring you together? Did it strengthen the black community?
The boycotts did a lot of things. Yes, it brought us together. I think it also brought out a lot of creative energy. People had to find creative solutions to some of the needs that were not being served because we were boycotting stores. I'm curious to this day what people did when they needed nails, mundane things like that. But as far as, for instance, we couldn't go to movies. And there were a lot of venues for seeing what were usually old movies, but there were block parties started around that time also. Lots of activities that never existed before. All of the youth groups at churches had many more dances in the summertime. I think partly because people were working together more closely on a day-to-day basis, and also to sort of keep people with a lot of restless energy from, seeking other things to do at a time when there had been already very few places for young people to go.
What impact did the boycotts have on the white businesses?
I think the boycotts were a big shock to white businesses in southern towns. I don't think they'd ever sat down and figured out, as they would have today, what percentage of their shoppers were black people in town. They, by and large, were somewhere between 40% and 60% of the business. So very quickly it had an immediate intense impact on daily business when black people stopped going in. And in my hometown, they lasted about a year. I know in North Carolina, there was one town that boycotted for 5 years before they had a serious negotiation. But in my hometown, the boycotts put people out of business very quickly, some of them.
So did the town really change?
The town changed totally. The main street of the town never came back. Businesses that left did not return, and smaller enterprises were bought up by chains and never reopened their doors. And people who wanted to stay in business had to move out to shopping centers because basically business stopped, and the center of town began to fail. I think that was pretty much the model, too.
My guest is writer Talani Davis. Her novel, 1959, is about the early days of desegregation through the eyes of a 12-year-old girl. More after this short break. This is Fresh Air.
Thank you. Writer Talani Davis is my guest. What do you think the permanent impact has been on you of that experience of having been chosen to integrate a school, although the school never went through with it, so you never had to follow through, but you were chosen, you were observed, and you were preparing yourself for it?
The permanent impact of that was to give me a fairly bad attitude about the whole idea. And I did try to write about this in the book, but by that I mean that the unstated question at hand in the integration situation was, were these kids good enough to be in a school with a mix of every kind of white student that might have lived in my hometown? And the assumption was that we were not as smart as the least intelligent white kid in that school. And it gave me this notion that, in a sense, a lot of people are raised with, that people are always measuring you, and as a black person, you have to go in and do better. But it gave me a bad attitude about that, that made me very competitive, but at the same time ingrained in me a notion that I had to prove nothing. I do not have to prove that I'm a human being. And maybe some people come to that later in life when they get into adulthood and they realize they don't have to explain themselves to anyone or defend themselves. But I knew I was a human being when I was 10, and when it was questioned when I was 12, it brought a certain anger to me that I'm still dragging around, I think.
So this idea of that you don't have to prove anything to anyone, how did that affect you in later years?
Oh, it affected me in bad ways and good. I you know, when I went to college, I did voter registration my freshman year when I maybe should have been going to class. And if I got called in about it, I would say, it's just as important to me to do voter registration as go to your class. I don't have to prove to you that I can make it through this school. When I went to Barnard, a fairly large proportion of the black women in my class were put on a program to take 6 years to get through the school. They were not asked if they would like to do this, but they were assumed not to be able to do it in the normal way, and they were given three classes instead of five. And I was not one of those, but they did want to know what I was doing with my time in the way a parent would, and I had a bad attitude about it because I knew I could handle the work there and I would be fine, you know. So I would get into conflict with them, perhaps more than the next student, because I had some sense that I was dealing with a hostile environment that was asking that question again. You know, that's how I reacted to it. When I came there, I had studied French for 8 years, and they asked me to be tested and to start in French 1 or 2 or something. And my response was, put me in the last year and let me flunk it. Because I knew I could make it, but I knew the institution would ask the question. And so I wasn't totally cooperative with the institution's idea of who I was supposed to be. And so it gave me what I would call a bad attitude, or a slight, you know, a rebellious attitude and a certain arrogance. And, you know, I don't know that all of that was useful to me, but I think that really stemmed from my childhood experiences.
Talani Davis, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Talani Davis's novel, 1959, will be published in paperback next month. She also wrote the libretto to the opera X, The Life and Times of Malcolm X, which was recently released on CD by Gramavision.
Joe Henderson and Christian McBride playing music by Billy Strayhorn. This is Fresh Air. Linda Wertheimer's with us. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Linda, Saddam Hussein has declared a ceasefire. How are you covering that?
We'll have a report from the United Nations, Terry, from Jim Zeroli, and we'll also talk to Ann Garrels, who's been keeping up with what's going on at the State Department. This has, of course, given a kind of extra twist to the inaugural. We are covering the inaugural hoopla. There have been some new appointments from the Clinton forces today. We also will have a piece on the Clinton agenda and a long look back at the Bush years and what that's meant. And, of course, the nominee who's the best candidate to get in trouble, Zoe Baird, will have a story from Nina Totenberg on that.
Thanks, Linda. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. The classical string quintet consists of two violins, two violas, and a cello. This was not an especially popular form until Mozart came along. His six quintets for strings are among his most beautiful and ambitious works of chamber music. Classical music critic Lord Schwartz says that the best performances of them he knows have recently been reissued on compact disc by Sony. He has a review.
Mozart wrote his first string quintet in 1773 when he was only 17. It's a very accomplished, elegant, and touching work. It was obviously a piece he took seriously. Several months after he composed it, he thoroughly revised sections of it. But Mozart's first quintet hardly prepares you for the five masterpieces that he began 14 years later. The first of these, Mozart converted from an earlier serenade for eight wind instruments in the dramatic key of C minor. The rest are completely original works, practically symphonic in scope, yet still chamber music of the most profound intimacy. Some people, to my amazement, still complain about Mozart being too precious, too rococo. Whenever I encounter these misguided souls, I suggest that they listen to the string quintet in G minor, which is one of the most disturbing and heartbreaking pieces of music ever written. On the other hand, in the quintets in C major and D major, there's also a hard easing lyricism, sunlight, even comedy. Budapest String Quartet obviously had a special feeling for these works, especially the later ones. The first quintet they recorded twice, the other five they recorded three times. In the 1940s, they were joined by violist Milton Kadams, who was a frequent partner of Pablo Casals and who was also a member of the NBC Symphony Orchestra under Toscanini. These recordings, originally on 78 RPM, were replaced in the mid-1950s by new recordings made directly for LP. Walter Trampler is the second violist. That was the first time they recorded the first quintet, and that's the version on this recent set. But in the 1940s, the Budapest was at one of its several zeniths. The playing is impeccable, and Kadams blends perfectly. It's marvelous to have these lost recordings back after so many decades in exile. CD set of Mozart quintets also includes Budapest Quartet collaborations on other Mozart chamber works. The tragic G minor piano quartet with Mstislav Wierzowski, the sublime clarinet quintet with David Oppenheim, and Eine kleine Nachtmusik in its original form for string quartet with double bass, played here by Julius Levine. These are later Budapest performances, not among their very best, but they'll do. And they make excellent companions for the quintets, which are among the greatest chamber music recordings ever made.
Lord Schwartz is classical music editor of the Boston Phoenix. He reviewed the Budapest Quartet playing Mozart quartets and quintets on the Sony series Legendary Interpretations. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Roberta Shurak directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, satirist Harry Shearer on the inauguration. Also, we talk with Elvis Costello about his new record, a collaboration with a string quartet. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.